Greetings, Earth Explorers. Welcome to X Squared Radio. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. We're coming to you live from an undisclosed location east of the Appalachians.
The spice is vital to space travel.
Our accu window forecast is 91 degrees and clear outside. We have a great program for you tonight. Got a drone wars update. Got a Fukushima update. Lots of good questions have been asked throughout the week by listeners all over the planet. We'll do our best to address those. If you want to be part of the program, we encourage you to do so. It is 888-429-5471. Also, our conference line is active tonight. If you want to call in there and participate just by listening, walking around with an informed smile on your face, that number is 760-569-7676. And the passcode is 192919#. Also, if you have a Droid phone, we have an app at xsquaredradio.com. Go there, click on the app, and you're in just like that. You can listen to any host on BBS Radio Channel 2 by clicking on that app. And you can certainly listen to this program live. Thank you so much for being here with us, whether you're traveling across the desert tonight or working on your favorite project. You are about to learn more about who we are, where we came from, and what we may become than you thought possible. But we might go a little past your imagination, but I have no fear. You will be safely traveling with me. So recline your chair, look out the window, and we're going to launch X Squared Radio. Here we go. The solar wind is cooking along at 457 kilometers per second, and the proton count is still high at 2.6 per cubic centimeter. Forecasters say solar maximum is still a year away, but earlier this month, sky watchers got a taste of things to come when a powerful flare sparked northern lights over the United States as far south as Arkansas, Colorado, and even California. The Earth-facing side of the sun is mostly blank and quiet today, but this could change in the days ahead as a new sunspot emerges over the sun's southeastern limb. NASA's Solar Dynamics Observatory can see the active region's magnetic canopy, which is towering over the limb of the sun in advance of the sunspot itself. It is on time to be massive. With the national load of water pumps and air conditioning running at full tilt, an influx of high-frequency energy from the sun could overload the national power grid. I suppose it really depends on which continent gets the direct hit of the impending flare. I can tell you that power distribution professionals are aware of the potential, but they really do not have a contingency plan in place other than to pull the plug if something big is coming. They would simply open the bus bars in the substations and keep the primary side of these large transformers from connecting to the power lines until it has passed. That could be anywhere from 5 hours to 72 hours. The businesses and communities who thought ahead and have placed into service some off-the-grid technologies like a fuel cell or solar panels or windmills or geothermal sources of energy will continue to prosper. Those who are linked to the grid may be dark for a while. The ones that don't really react quickly enough will be dark for a long time, perhaps up to 2 years. You could also do this for your home, although for energy, it's a little difficult to do without a sizable capital investment. Coming up very shortly, it is now July 2012. This year is going to unfold faster than I think you or I are ready for it. But that being said, There are things that you can do to get yourself mentally and physically prepared. Coming up on August 10th, we have the Wake Up Now conference in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Many of you live close to this. It's only $50. I'll be speaking there, and this is going to be a rousing conference. I think it's the second annual one, and they're doing a great job putting a good line of speakers together, myself notwithstanding. And I'm sure you're going to enjoy it, but it's easy on the pocketbook and within driving distance for many of you. And then on in October, we have two conferences, the Pythagoras Conference on October 10th in Indiana. And then there's another conference, which I will post the information to next week. George Norrie will be hosting that one, and I'll be speaking at both of these conferences. Go to xsquaredradio.com. And you can see the banners on the right-hand side. The Wake Up Now conference is there. The Pythagoras conference is there. By the way, if you use that Pythagoras conference banner, you save $100 off this four-day event. 50 speakers from around the world. This is a great value if you want to take in a conference with world-class speakers at it. And then on December 13th, we leave Houston for Chichen Itza for the Maya 2012 conference. That one would be the conference of a lifetime. If you really wanted to have stories to tell someone, myself, Greg Braden, Maureen St. Germain, several Mayan elders, others are going to be there. This is ground zero, by the way, for the entire 2012 awareness and saga, which was started by the Maya 1,500 years ago. Now, people ask me all the time what they can do to prepare for the coming days of chaos, and I tell them the same things that I say in my book, Alienated Nation. Number one, slowly, carefully, get the bulk of your cash out of the banks. Put it in your possession. Jars, boxes, bundles, or under the mattress. Bail it if you have to. If you have any debt at all, cash in your 401k and pay it off. Take the 10%, tax it, and get out of debt. If you don't do this, your entire fortune may be grabbed and spent by the federal government or the bank itself. It's your money. Cash it in and pay off your debts. And that comes directly not from me, but from Ann Barnhart, who is a financial professional, former brokerage house owner. She closed her brokerage house to save her clients from losing all their money because she could not protect them against the likes of MF Global, John Corzine, Mr. Financial Corruption himself, who stole, yes, I use that word, it's strong, but it's true, $1.2 billion from his depositors. And keep in mind, these were mostly small depositors. The average deposit was only $10,000. He stole their money, and they never saw it again, and there's no recourse for them because their money was available for a money market. Even though it wasn't invested, it was available for it, and that makes it ineligible for FDIC. Many of your funds are the same way. If the brokerage house loses your money, there's nothing you can do about it. And what happened to MF Global, John Corzine, Jamie Dimon, the $2 billion that they lost, is probably a little more than that, with J.P. Morgan Stanley, is just the tip of the iceberg. This occurs when financial industries margin themselves out. Now, John Corzine margined his company out 90%. That is to say, they only had 10% of the actual cash to back their investments. And when the investments went south, their bets went bad. They had to make those bets good, which is why they, instead of taking the hit themselves, stole the money from their depositors and tried to at least recover their own personal lifestyles while ruining the savings accounts of thousands and thousands of customers. The same thing could happen to you, absolutely. I know my 401k went down 75%. Yeah, 75%. 5% in 4 years. So I took it out of the control of the brokerage house that was handling it by ordering the sale of every single one of the mutual funds that they had me invested in. I sold them all. And then I took the cash and I paid off all my debts, everything, every credit card, cars, house, everything, paid it off. And I've been debt-free ever since. And let me tell you, your life gets so simple when you have to write no checks each month for nothing. The second thing is to get some food storage together. And as you know, if you've been a long-time listener to this program, we're in our eighth year this coming September. Get food storage together. And we've been searching for and have found a great food storage supplier for you. We're working with them to get their web presence improved and build a 72-hour kit through them for you. This company is so good, the food is so good, you may want to make it part of your regular food chain. Now, next month, in August, we're going to launch this. I'm not going to tell you the name yet because they're not ready for you. But next month they will be. We're going to introduce you to them, and I know you're going to like it. I know you need it. I know you need it, because otherwise people would not be asking me, what do we do to get prepared? I get it in mail. I get it in Skype messages. I get it in phone calls. So next month we will post that on the web. You can go there, purchase at your leisure. Use your PayPal account, use your credit card, send them a money order, whatever. You need to invest in food because you do not want to be a burden on FEMA. The disasters that may be coming, cataclysms, regional upheavals that may be coming, will be so great that a nation strapped for cash might be the last person coming to your assistance. You need to be able to take care of yourself. That's the American way. You can do that. Now, this weekend has a lot of things happening to it. Asteroids are flying by this weekend. Oh, yeah. You can go to the website or you can go to space.com and you can get the list of the asteroids. But right now, there is a city block size asteroid and will fly by Earth this weekend, well beyond the orbit of the moon. And you can watch it zip safely by in a live online webcast. The asteroid 2002 AM31 will make its closest approach to Earth on Sunday, that's today, when it will pass by at a range of about 3.2 million miles. That's about 13.7 times the distance between the Earth and the Moon. On Sunday, the SLU space camera, Skywatching website, will host two live webcasts to offer internet denizens views of the space rock from telescopes at the Prescott Observatory in Arizona. Asteroid 2002 AM31 has no chance of hitting Earth this weekend, scientists say, though it is on the watch list as an object that may one day pose a future concern. It's been identified in 2002. It's now been going by us on a perennial basis for 10 years. And each pass, the irregular orbit of this asteroid is perturbed by various gravitational bodies in space. And so we never know from 1 year to the next what it's going to do until it gets, you know, close enough to make some predictions. The space rock is listed as a potentially hazardous asteroid, that's a PHA in the terminology, by the Minor Planet Center at Cambridge, Massachusetts. 2002 AM31 was discovered and tracked by radar at NASA's Deep Space Radio Antenna in Goldstone, California, and at the Arecibo Observatory in Puerto Rico for its flyby this weekend. Near-Earth asteroid 153958, that's 2002 AM31, represents one of approximately 9,000 asteroids whizzing past Earth at any given moment. And we wanted to highlight this one as it's only 13.7 what we call lunar distances from Earth, and well over one city block in size. Just to keep you posted. Now, the professional community gets a little bit more warning than you did. You learned about it today. It's passing by today. I'm going to have to start this program with two glasses of grapefruit juice because it is so good, especially on a blazingly hot day like this. And we'll try to keep you posted because we want to give you as much warning, so much heads up as possible. And I'm sure that the National News Services will be doing a great job at keeping you posted as to what to do if we have a planet-changing collision coming our way. I'm sure you're confident in that, right? All right. We have covered a lot of green articles, green technologies, and I appreciate the feedback on them. It's powerful stuff. Appreciate all the good work that people do vetting and evaluating and making sure that this stuff is accurate, because the last thing in the world I want to be is inaccurate. But one of the main criticisms that we find is that there is a lot of what's typically called crony capitalism going on. This rewards high-profile supporters with federal dollars. I hate to say it, but the stories are true. The story extends well beyond Solyndra. It can be said that Solyndra is just a good political sledgehammer to hit the president over the head, because he pushes the green energy and green forms of technology out there, and I think he should be applauded for that if that is what he is doing. Recent coverage has shed light on the president's connections to two individuals specifically, Steve Wesley and John Doerr. The latter is a partner at Kleiner Perkins Caulfield and Byers, a Silicon Valley venture capital firm whose portfolio includes 16 recipients of federal money under the current administration. I know people at Kleiner Perkins. In fact, one of the members there sits on an advisory board of one of my companies. So I know this group. They have been successful in raising money for companies out there that are involved in green technologies. Now, Doerr is helping to create the biggest new market the world has seen since the dawn of the oil industry, and asking for taxpayer dollars to do it. Condé Nast Portfolios' Russ Mitchell wrote in 2007. Now, that's before Obama even came on the scene. 2 years later, the San Francisco Chronicle reported that Doerr saw hope of a revised green energy industry under Obama. He has been meeting with Obama's transition team and leaders in Congress to urge them to use the new economic stimulus package to modernize the electric grid and offer new incentives to help clean energy startups get off the ground. And that is just what they did, sort of, to the benefit of numerous Kleiner Perkins investments. Doerr, meanwhile, sat on the president's Economic Recovery Advisory Board, advising the administration on how to spend stimulus dollars. Wesley, who bundled between $700,000 and $1 million for Obama's two campaigns, and sits on an Energy Department Advisory Board, also unabashedly mixes politics and business. His venture capital firm, the Wesley Group, saw federal green dollars steered to at least four companies in his portfolio. Government is not always bad, he says, and especially for something that is going to affect your business, you should be involved with it, Wesley reportedly told Mark Tarpening, founder of Wesley Group Investment, Tesla Motors. He encouraged us to think about Washington, Tarpening said. While Wesley and Doerr are high-profile examples of what can fairly be termed venture corporatists, VC executives who see government support as an integral to a successful investment strategy, Other examples have received little scrutiny, even as the presidential campaign has focused more attention on crony capitalism. Wesley was heavily involved in the Solyndra loan guarantee, even exchanging emails with top administration officials about the company. But other venture corporatists were involved in the Solyndra saga as well. Now, I just want to offer my personal perspective on this, and it goes a little, well, it goes well beyond just an unrelated engineer. I am integrally involved in the process of bringing some green technology to the market. No, I have not received any money from the government. No, I have not received any loan guarantees or low interest loans or anything, not a dime, not a penny from the government. But we do see that these risk benefits, shall we say, are being funneled into the industry. But they are being funneled well above a glass ceiling. That glass ceiling appears to be, at least from my observation, and I am a pretty good observer and I'm pretty factual in my research. The companies that received the money, almost to a firm, were worth at least $1 billion and were multinational corporations. That is to say, they had national, American, and offshore owners. And unfortunately, over 80% of those recipients were also large contributors to the administration. Now, that is something that we just don't like to see. And not so much because, you know, Solyndra maybe had technology that was not obsolete, but maybe priced out of the market. There are a couple questions come to mind. Why was it priced out of the market? Well, the main reason is that cheap Chinese, and I mean cheap and expensive Chinese materials, were flooding the U.S. market. How were they flooding the U.S. market? Well, because businesses and consumers receive tax incentives. Some of those are tax rebates. Some of those are discounts, and some of those are actually write-offs for capital investment. In other words, if you were to improve a structure like that, property taxes that you pay or capital gains taxes that you would pay on that investment, if it's held up to 5 years, go down to practically nothing. So lots and lots of good benefits for doing it. But the money was mostly spent in China. That is to say, if a business received, say, $30,000 toward a $100,000 investment in solar technology, they simply went and spent the money in China. They didn't spend the money in America. There were no restrictions placed upon those incentive funds to buy American. And so the Chinese made out like robbers. I mean, they took American money, you know, by the millions and millions and millions of dollars, billions of dollars. And American companies suffered because China subsidizes these companies with free labor, virtually free raw materials, and they do so that they can openly compete and put out of business any competing industries around the world. In fact, almost all of the solar suppliers in America right now use the Chinese solar chip. That is just a fact. If you look at go to any solar panel company you want to find on the web, do a Google search on it. I won't do it for you now, but trust me, if you do it, you'll see the actual solar panel itself is almost identical. Now, the technology behind it, how it uses that power, how it provides, you know, resistance or frequency feedback to the chips themselves, how they cover them, how they reflect light to them, that varies from place to place. But the actual silicon layer, crystal layer itself, comes from China. And I guess Solyndra had their own coating technology where they were using tubes instead of sheets, and they simply could not compete with the cheap Chinese product. And so $500 million later, and probably 4 years too late, the company went belly up. What we would have liked to have seen, and what I think would have been far more successful, would have been to see those funds do two things. Those stimulus funds that were put into green energy do two things. One, that they were put into small or medium-sized businesses, less than $1 billion, that were completely American-owned and operated. And the second is that the customers that received the funds to make the purchases for these energy devices were restricted to using those funds on American-made products. If those two things would have happened, the stimulus probably would have worked. Now, where there's a lot of money placed out by the government, you're going to see lobbyists and you're going to see professional people who know how to get into these government meetings and spend money and write the right documents, flock. One of those is Rockport Capital Partners. David Prenz, Rockport Capital Partners, owns a 7.5% stake in Solyndra. Like Wesley, Prenz exchanged emails with Department of Energy officials about Solyndra, specifically how to get the word out about the company, as well as another Rockport portfolio company, according to the Washington Post. Prend sits on another advisory board for DOE's National Renewable Energy Lab, that's the NREL, and chairs another DOE panel advising the department on solar energy. He's the chairman of the panel. Rockport general partner Chuck McDermott, who also advises the National Renewable Energy Laboratory as part of its Venture Capital Advisory Committee. These guys... usually what they do is they review applications and offerings from companies to make sure that they actually have viable technology, that they're not just, you know, snowing a bunch of bureaucrats in Washington. These guys are professionals in the industry, and they are the ones that ultimately make the decision who gets the money and who doesn't. Well, during his 12 years of senior-level energy and environmental policy work in Washington, D.C., boasts McDermott's company bio, Chuck established strong administrative and strategic relationships that have put him at the forefront of clean tech policy deliberations today. So you can see how private industry works their way into the agency government, in this case the Department of Energy, on several panels, and these panels make the decisions on who gets the money and who doesn't. Now, Element Partners. Rockport-backed Solyndra cooled national enthusiasm for green energy investment. Oh, they got the word out all right, but it wasn't the word they wanted. So in May of this year, Obama visited an Iowa wind energy facility to call for more federal spending on green energy. The company that hosted him? TPI Composites. They received $9 million in stimulus tax credits in 2010. A year before, TPI raised $26 million in capital from investors. That included the VC firm Element Partners. Six Element investments, including TPI, have received federal support under Obama. Element's most prominent political connections come by way of two of its operating partners, former Pennsylvania governor and Democratic National Committee Chairman Ed Rendell, and Kathleen McGinty, who was appointed by Rendell as Secretary of the Pennsylvania Department of Environmental Protection. It's sort of like a state-level EPA. That's what they do. McGinty, who the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette describes as a protege of Al Gore, formerly served as chair of the White House Council on Environmental Quality, founding director of the White House Office on Environmental Policy, and a senior environmental advisor to Gore. White House visitor logs show she visited Nancy Sutley, the current chair of the Council on Environmental Quality, in 2010 to discuss the National Environmental Policy Act. Now, another VC group, Vantage Point Capital Partners. Many of you are familiar with this company, BrightSource Energy. There has been some press about BrightSource lately, And I want to say that the press was not on Bright Source Energy. It mentioned Bright Source Energy as a possible another Solyndra. And I think it was this disingenuous. Hold on while I take a sip. Bright Source has designed, successfully built, and successfully operates several solar power stations. They do it a little bit differently. They collect the sunlight, beam it to a solar collector. They then use that energy to make steam to turn turbines to make electricity. All of these facilities have been operating for years and years, some over a decade, successfully and profitably. And the one in New Mexico is not only under construction, it's ahead of schedule. Is it New Mexico or Arizona? Maybe it's Arizona. It's under construction. It's ahead of schedule. It's fully funded. And all of the power that it will make for the next 10 years is already pre-sold. Bright Energy, Bright Source Energy, a high-profile recipient of stimulus investment, has received significant attention due to the connections it enjoyed through former Commerce Secretary John Bryson. That's the guy that just had the very mysterious hit-and-run accident, who was allegedly taking some over-the-counter sleep medication and just zoned out while he was driving. He has since resigned, who was the chairman of the company's board. But Bright Source also had significant connections through one of its top investors, VC firm Vantage Point Capital Partners. Vantage Point principal Sanjay Waggle, it's either Waggle or Wagley, headed Clean Tech for Obama during the 2008 campaign, the first outside group to meet with Obama's transition team after the election. In March of 2009, Waggly left Vantage Point for the Energy Department. There's more of that revolving door we keep talking about, where he was a renewable energy grants advisor for the stimulus package. Same kind of role that was played before. These industry professionals, this guy on the investment side, who looks at the offerings and solicitations as they're filled out by professional companies who are applying for grants, and decides who gets the money and who doesn't. And he was later the Associate Director of Commercialization at the Department of Energy's Advanced Research Projects Agency. Vantage Point also enjoyed the political pull of venture partner and senior advisor Robert F. Kennedy Jr. and a board member, Steve Dolezalek, who also sits on the Center for American Progress's Clean Tech Council, was personally in contact with DOE official Jonathan Silver regarding a stimulus loan for Bright Source's Ivanpah Solar Project. It's the Ivanpah Solar Project that was the subject of the recent speculative journalism that came out a couple of weeks ago. It was unwarranted. Ivanpah is on schedule. Ivanpah is on budget, and it is going to be profitable. Bright Source was one of four Vantage Point investments to receive federal backing under Obama. There's another one, Good Energies. Solar Reserve, which got a $737 million loan guarantee under the stimulus. What this does, just to give you an example of how this works, these companies have to qualify for the loan first. They have to actually go get the loan approved at the bank, which means they got to have a P&L, they got to have capital, they got to have management, they got to have a viable plan. Banks don't take risks unnecessarily. Once they get the bank approval, then they can go to the government and apply for a loan guarantee. But they can't apply for the loan guarantee until they're already approved for the loan on their own. Now, what this loan guarantee program does of the Department of Energy is it virtually 100% guarantees that small business cannot take part in the program. Obviously, a small business cannot go out and get the bank loan first. only companies with well-established cash flows and the ability to pay can get the loan guarantees. They had investors and connections both to the energy department and to the president himself. One of its financiers, VC firm Good Energy, employed David Sandilow, you know who he was, a senior advisor until he left for DOE to be Secretary Stephen Chu's principal advisor on energy policy. His undersecretary, Christine Johnson, resigned in disgrace or was asked to leave after mucho corruption, and I can personally tell you that the policy that the Department of Energy has never, does not now, and never intends to give grants to small businesses came directly from her staff. And I can tell you that on a factual basis. So, you know, the average public can say, well, small business is risky and taxpayers shouldn't take risks like that. And yet these high-profile risks like Solyndra and other companies that do fail are the ones that get the press. And naturally, the president's enemies are going to beat him up over that. I dare say that these are not the same people that make up the reports and the articles about the successes that are had by the Department of Energy. The agency is not a complete and utter failure. It does a lot of great things, and it has a lot of great potential to do great things. And that potential is not realized because of what many perceive to be deep and widespread corruption in the agency. It comes naturally from this revolving door, from these VC firms, and government officials who have served on committees or chaired different policy committees and these agencies. So they're moving in a way that appears to be and absolutely is a conflict of interest. Is it illegal? Probably not. Should it be illegal? What do you think? 888-429-5471. Now let's get to the big boys. We've talked about these small VC companies enough. Let's talk about the big ones. Citigroup. Solar Reserve also enjoyed the backing of City Alternatives. The fund's former managing director, Michael Froman, is a college friend of Obama, helping him break into the New York City fundraising circuit during the 2008 campaign, sat on his transition team, and now serves as a deputy assistant to the president. During the campaign, Froman had a long list of New York finance friends who would be willing to part with some cash for the right cause, the Washington Post reported. Froman helped to get Obama in the door and even persuaded certain financiers who had strong ties in the community to support Obama. Froman bundled himself at least $200,000 for the president. That's how to win friends and influence people. White House Chief of Staff Jack Lew is the former COO at City Alternatives, which also invested in the stimulus beneficiary Solar City. So you see how this arm's length relationship between these individuals works. Silver Lake and DBL Investors. Solar City enjoyed backing from two other notable VC firms, Silver Lake Craftwork and DBL Investors. The former is owned by Soros Fund Management. Before joining Silver Lake in 2011 as a partner, Kathy Zoe served as acting undersecretary for energy and assistant secretary for energy efficiency and renewable energy. While at the DOE, Zoe's husband, his company got $584,000 in stimulus tax credits. This is known as New Market Tax Credits. My memory of this program, it seems to work like this. The Treasury Department creates a tax credit for emerging technologies. States or agencies in the states create an application for these new market tax credits. Then they resell those credits to investors at a discount. In other words, the Treasury will offer, let's say they offer $50 million worth of tax write-offs. Well, those write-offs are very valuable to companies who are making a profit. They want those write-offs, and they're willing to pay for them. Now, not dollar for dollar. I mean, they might as well just pay the tax. But let's say that it's 30 cents on the dollar. So the investor puts up $16.37 million, and he gets $50 million worth of tax write-offs. The Treasury makes out because the company invests $16.37 million into the private sector. The small business that they invest in makes out because they obviously get the money and they're able to get up and off the ground without recourse. The state makes out because that company investing the money creates jobs, which creates payroll taxes, which at least 15% of that payroll gets injected right back into the community where the paycheck is written. So everybody wins. And ostensibly what's being done is that the Treasury is creating money by doing nothing but offering tax write-offs. These are called new market tax credits. They ended completely in 2010. Some of the states were successful. Indiana, California, Ohio, Kentucky applied twice and got them. And the third time applied for $150 million. They expected to get 50. And of that 50, they expected to see about half of that in investment funds coming into various companies. So some of it was only $2 or $3 million per company. Some was $5 to $10 million per company. But they had a really good list of companies. They applied the third time. They had it down. They knew the ropes. And those applications sat on the desk of Congress for a year, aged out, and died. So new market tax credits are no more. DBL Investors, whose portfolio boasts four federally backed companies, including SolarCity, enjoys the influence of managing partner Nancy Fund, a charter member of the National Advisory Council for Environmental Policy and Technology, which advises the Environmental Protection Agency, the EPA, and partner Seth Miller, who, according to his bio, has worked on environmental policy issues for the White House and the United States Senate. So now you see this deep and wide relationship, and there's tons of money. We're talking about hundreds of billions of dollars. 23.5 billion dollars in the Electric Vehicle Proliferation Fund, in the Advanced Vehicle Technology Fund. There are a lot of money, and when you have a lot of money and you have this revolving door between VCs, government officials, and council and policymakers, you have the makings for corruption. Oh, I forgot to mention one thing. An administration that was hell-bent on re-election. We know, we suspect strongly that this campaign season for the presidency will see approximately $1 billion spent in an effort to reelect Barack Obama. Those kinds of numbers are staggering. No one man could bear such an expense by himself. It can't be done. Normally, it takes the works of the support of millions and millions of voters who send in $5, $10, $20, $100, I think is the maximum. But even more normally, what happens is if you have these connections and access to very, very large sums of money, which takes a lot of the risk out of investment for some of these VC firms, puts you on a track most of the time toward early profitability and thus high share prices and thus awesome exit strategies, you have a pathway for corruption. Well, One needn't allege a political payoff to root out the impetus for venture corporatism. In fact, the senior vice president for Wesley-backed company, Amyris, summed up the political nature of green energy investment quite well. We found that Steve Wesley is very helpful and insightful in understanding the political landscape, I'll bet, especially from the energy side. Because of his past in D.C., he has been able to get some introductions. Once he introduces us, it's our job to actually do the work and show whoever he has introduced us to the value we can bring. Well, that is the big thing, isn't it? To get that introduction, to get in that door, to get past the receptionist, to get upstairs into the boardroom where you can actually speak to the decision makers. How many of you, Earth Explorers, get that kind of access? How many of you have small businesses and have been able to walk in at the highest levels of government and make your presentation? That's what I thought. But firms that don't enjoy such political backing don't get those introductions. Clean tech companies that enjoy political connections benefit from the very fundamental advantage of being noticed by the officials that control Washington's green energy purse strings. Serving in government with those officials or donating money to the people who appoint them can open doors unavailable to run-of-the-mill businesses. Let's see what Roland from Los Angeles has to say. Welcome to the program, sir. There he is.
Hi, how you doing?
I'm doing fine. What's on your mind?
Not much. We have some interesting things out here in California. They're cutting all kinds of budget problems they're having out here. So they're cutting all kinds of city budgets. And interesting thing is, not only did San Bernardino file for bankruptcy, but also Stockton, California, and Mammoth Lakes, California.
Well, I think Compton just filed, too, didn't they?
Did Compton file, too? That's a
yep.
new one.
Compton, San Bernardino.
We're all falling in line. You know, here's a question I have. By bankrupting the cities, will they then be able to require the employees to either go back in their pay and take cuts and benefit cuts, or will they be able to retain the wages they're making today?
I think the wages are probably safe, but the pensions are definitely targeted. Once the city files bankruptcy, the long-term obligation that they have for the pensions contractually collapses. Now, what they can do is they can offer people short-term buyouts. In other words, if you're sitting out there, you retired after 30 years with the city, and you're now 48 years old, you're going to live another 50 years. The city can't afford to pay you that pension. But what they can do is they can offer to give you a short-term buyout, let's say $100,000 or $200,000 or something like that. So instead of waiting for, you know, $8,000 or $9,000 a year in your pension, you can take it as a lump sum and get out. And that's what most of them will do. The ones that don't want to settle will probably just lose their pensions.
All together. What do you think
they'll
do to their benefits?
Well, the thing about public employees getting a what's called a defined benefit. This is where, let's say you work as a county court clerk for 30 years, or you work as a school superintendent or a fireman. Normally, the way cities have worked in the past, and this is just because this is the way that officials got elected, very similar to Greece, very similar to Spain, is you promise the public employees something they can't get in the private sector, which is called a defined benefit. This is what you're going to get come hell or high water. Well, that sounds wonderful, but eventually you can't deliver. You can't deliver. And so it's going to be replaced with what's called employee contribution plans. That is very similar to what it would be if you worked for a factory or Walmart or whatever. You take a certain amount of your pay, you put it into 401k, the company matches it, and it grows and earns interest, and it belongs to the company. It's a company asset, but it's in your name. That's something that's manageable. So these defined benefit plans have to collapse. There's no possible way they can survive. They have to go to...
Is it all nationwide like this?
Well, I think it's going to start in the smaller areas because they don't have the resources to pull from. And, you know, I would like to also say that primarily it's happening in California because California has blocked the harvesting of many sources of energy that California has. California sits on one of the largest oil reserves in the world, but the state will not allow them to drill it.
So you think that other states will follow suit with California?
I think some will. States that have good revenue, like obviously North Dakota, no, they're not going to follow California.
Right.
But I think states that don't have a municipal source of revenue, that is to say they don't have a natural gas reserve, they don't have a coal reserve, they don't have minerals or lumber or something like that that they can actually market to the world, they have to rely on the private sector and their investment and their risk. They're going to collapse. They have to. There's no other way around it. This defined benefit plan that's been around since the early 60s has to come to an end. It is what is destroying municipalities. It's what the whole Wisconsin election was over.
Really? Wow. Well, you know, it's interesting. Maybe it's the states that are reliant on the service sector heavily instead of the manufacturing and, like you said, mining, forestry, all those things. Maybe they just can't.
Yeah, the answer is yes. Drive through West Virginia today. Take I-77 north through West Virginia, and what you will see when you get up into coal country is huge billboards that say, "Welcome to Obama's no work zone," because all of the coal mines are closed because the federal government has made burning coal prohibitively expensive.
So that brings up the question, how is your green business doing when you're pushing a little more to go into the car manufacturing of electric cars?
It's doing okay. Right now there's about $5 trillion sitting on the sidelines in the United States doing nothing but trading currency. It isn't being invested at all. In fact, I have it on good authority. I have good friends at Merrill Lynch. There are fewer than 500 people out of 335 million people in the United States. There are fewer than 500 people that could write a check for $10 million in this country. That's it's worse than it's been since World War II.
Wow. I didn't know it was that bad.
It's worse than that.
That's pretty astounding.
It's worse than that because if those individuals were to actually write a liquid check for $10 million, the bank they drew it on would probably collapse.
Wow, that'd be worse. You know, they said the housing starts up again, too. I heard that on a news broadcast. I question. They said that they're way up in Seattle, Washington. They didn't mention a lot of other places. The question I have is, do you think the Chinese are coming in and buying those houses? They got a lot of money.
It's hard to say. The thing about Chinese money, a lot of people don't understand this, Chinese billionaires are actually prisoners in their own country. I sat across the table in China from a billionaire who owned more than 60 major businesses in China, and yet he could not send his daughter to Disney World. China would not allow him nor any member of his family to leave the country. China does not
even use it for what he wanted.
Exactly. China does not allow capital to leave the country. If they did, because the Chinese yuan is so strong, worldwide because the Chinese artificially right. inflate their money. The Chinese right. literally could come in and buy half the state of Florida. They could buy California. They could buy all the ports in California. Oh, sure. They could buy all the trains and utilities in California. But they're forbidden from doing so without government approval. And that's where the problem
is. Oh, okay. So if they get government approval to buy something, then they can do it.
Yes. Yes. And, I will say it doesn't take much for housing starts to be up in Seattle. Because right. Seattle was at, and most of the large cities are at a complete standstill when it comes to building new homes. There is a glut of
yeah.
homes.
I mean, here in Los Angeles area, other than apartments and multiple housing, you don't see much of anything going on.
That's true. That's true. When I was a kid in Santa Monica, they were bulldozing blocks of houses that were built in the 40s and 50s to build condos and apartment buildings. They right. had to increase the density of people living in those areas between Washington, California, and Wilshire Boulevard. And so right. those old houses had to be bulldozed, all the little greenhouses and stuff that existed back in the 40s and 50s and little duplexes and stuff all had to go away, and they all went to high-density condo and apartments.
Well, that's what they're doing here. I mean, you're watching the construction in the area, at least in the San Fernando Valley where I live, and you can see that the apartments are being built again, or condos, or wherever it might be.
That's because people don't have the capital to put into a home. I mean, come on, a 2,000-square-foot house in California is going to sell for about $1 million.
Yep, in a nice area. Yep. And the ones that, you know, the ones that aren't in the nice areas and are not as, not a really bad area, but just not the most desirable area, those are probably going for $200 to $300. And people can't even afford those.
Well, they're also, as my studio just let me know, they're building what are called micro pads or micro lots. And these are, you know, between 250 and 800 square feet. I mean, these are really, really small. Basically, they're
almost like lots or studios.
Yeah, they're studio apartments. So wow. He's saying some of them are the size of a jail cell, like 15 by 10. They're called micropods.
You know, somebody told me when they were in Japan, they had some kind of weird deal. Not exactly like that, but similar to that. You know, where they could stay in these rooms that were just extremely small.
I have stayed in them. I stayed in a room. The bathroom was a fiberglass drop-in. It had a sink, commode, and shower, and a floor all in it. Just slips into the room. It had a less than single wide bed. This bed was about 4 feet wide and about 5'10" long. And it went from the window to the edge of the bathroom. And then there was an area where you could walk sideways between a small desk with a TV on it. And that's it. The room was 120 square feet.
If you're
going to concentrate, you know, on doing business, you don't need a big pad to walk around in. You know, these things are anywhere from $20 to $100 a night, which is almost impossible to find in big cities. And if you're going to go there and spend a week, you know, these are like hostels that you find in Europe. They're just someplace to throw your backpack. You know, they might have a central shower on one floor that you go down to and, you know, take a shower. That's the way they are in Tibet, and that's the way they are. Well, they are in the Midwest, too. I've stayed in hotels that had a single shower on a floor, all the rooms shared.
You know, I just thought, I mean, if California, and this is the bring immigration into the state, they want to raise health tax in November to cover the school systems and to stop higher tuition. The problem is, they're saying they want the top end of the sector that's making money, you know, top 10% to pay these bills and taxes. But if they raise the sales tax, isn't going to work that way. It's going to affect everyone. So you got people that can't even afford to eat, okay, and they're having trouble making their bills for everything. And those people are going to be paying even more. Now, how does that work?
Well, you bring up a really good question. We're right at the top of the hour, Colin, Rollin. So what I'm going to ask you to do is I'm going to ask you to hang on through the break, because this is a really important question, and it goes actually to the core of the Republic. So I really want to discuss it in detail. Can you hang on to the break?
Absolutely.
All right. We'll take about 5 minutes. Don't go away, Earth Explorers.
No problem. I'll be right here.
All right. Don't go away, Earth Explorers. We'll be right back with more X Squared Radio.
Thank you. Welcome back, Crypt Explorers, to the second hour of X-Squared Radio. We're running just a little bit behind, so I have to cut this this hour short. But our AccuWeather window forecast, the sun has finally gone down. It's about 85 degrees outside, much more comfortable. By the way, the International Space Station is making passes at about 5 o'clock in the morning Eastern Time. So if you want to check out the nature, take advantage of that. Not many people get to look at it. Also, do not forget about the conferences coming up. We have the Wake Up Now conference, August 10th in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Please click on that banner at X Squared Radio. $50. Drive yourself down there, have a good time at the conference, and learn something. I will fade this out, and we will begin our second hour. Ron Rollins on hold in California. And the reason I want to keep him on is he's tapped into a really, really big subject. It's so big, in fact, that I'm adding a chapter to the book, and I'm gonna reissue it, and I'll re-record that so people who have access to the audiobook can get it. There are two things that keep a nation free, really, when you get down to it. No. It's not the Second Amendment. It's not guns, okay? The two things that keep a nation free, the first is the freedom of speech, freedom of the press, being able to keep tabs on government, report on it, and have the people stay aware of it. You don't let the bad people get away with stuff. You tell people about it. The second, and probably even more important, even Jefferson agreed with me, or I agree with him, is a decentralized, locally controlled education system. And that's what we're going to talk about in the beginning of this hour, because Roland just pushed the button, and it's a good subject to talk about. Because for the last, I'm going to say, 15 years, locally controlled, decentralized educational system has been assaulted like the siege of the castle walls. Not just one effort, multiple efforts, and not just a little bit of money. Billions of dollars have been spent doing this. Why? Why is it, healthcare? We got the healthcare thing going. That's going to be, I don't know, how many trillions of dollars out of our economy taken by the federal government. But education, why do that? Where's the money in that? You're about to find out. Roland, welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Bert.
Okay, ask your question again. Let's kick this hour off.
Okay. People that don't have the money right now to pay their bills and to pay for their food and their expenses of their car and to get to work and everything else they have to do, if the taxes increase of sales tax, for example, in California, how are these people going to be able to support their families and themselves?
Well, you had brought up how this applies to tuition. If they raise tuition, how can it...
The top 10%, supposedly in California, will pay most of the tax increase, of the sales tax. How can it be possible when it turns out that everybody has to pay the same?
But they all, the top 10% find a way out of that, though. They always find a way out of it. They put it in the name of corporations. They live on dividends, which pay a 15% tax rate. That's what Mitt Romney did. All successful people do that. They don't own things personally. They put them in the name of foundations. They put them in the name of corporations and LLCs, which are all taxed differently. So the top 10% aren't really going to pay those taxes. But you had mentioned that one of the things that people could not afford to do was pay tuition to get a higher education.
Right.
A better job.
You have to pay tuition. The school systems are failing here in California. It's a mess.
Right. And what I was going to say is, I was going to ask the question, with the web out here, the world's largest free speech library, we have the best of both worlds. We not only have free speech, we not only have a free press, unfettered, untaxed, but we also have unlimited knowledge. And unlimited knowledge put in the hands of smart people is always going to have positive results. It's going to have massive results. My question is, do you think that institutional education, accredited universities, etc., are going to lose their franchise on the value of education. You see, when I talk about education being assaulted like the castle walls, I don't mean that they're trying to take it down. I mean that they're trying to control it. And when they try to control it, they're trying to change the philosophy of education. Education, when my grandmother went to school, was a one-room school, all 8 grades in the same room, and my grandmother was a genius. She was brilliant. In fact, many of the people that founded this nation, that fueled the Industrial Revolution, went to school in one-room schools. Almost right. No money was spent on their education, and because they're smart people and they had access to information. Well, we still have that, and yet corporations refuse to even interview people unless they have a college degree. And what they're missing out on is a huge, very valuable resource of undegreed engineers, because these people had
not just engineers, but everything.
That's exactly
there's
right.
A lot of people that learned through the internet or whatever means they've used, they have a lot of knowledge on a lot of different factors. A lot of personal.
Let's say you spend $20,000 on tuition. You go sit in a classroom, read a textbook that's 3 years old, lessons from a professor who has never worked in the private sector. He was taught by a professor who was taught by a professor. His information is outdated, and information is moving so quickly now that universities should be tapping into this. They shouldn't even be printing textbooks anymore. All the textbooks should be PDF files, and students should be able to learn at their own pace instead of sitting there taking notes, trying to keep up with the idiosyncrasies of a professor. And if you really do have a good professor, he should be teaching tens of thousands of students online instead of 24 kids at a time in a semester.
Exactly. But they can't make any money off that if they can't off books.
Ah, now you've hit the nail on the head. For the institutional educational system, it's about making money. But for the principle of education, the government, and I'm going to say the agency government that is completely interwoven with some of the nation's largest unions and their leadership, government believes that education, and you're going to hear this more and more and more, especially in this campaign, is about training you to get a job. Back in the 90s and early 2000s, we called this the School to Work program, STW, Goals 2000, Education Edge. It went by many names. But that is not the role of education. The role of education is to teach you how to learn.
Right.
And you educate yourself.
You have to learn yourself, and they teach you the tools that you use to do that.
Correct. Correct. We can fill your head full of all kinds of trivia, which you can go stick your finger down your throat and regurgitate onto your test paper and get your degree. But are you really educated? No. You got the degree, but you have no education.
I was just at a restaurant, and they had a show on TV. Are you smarter than a five-year-old? All these guys were watching this show. I said, well, are you smarter than a five-year-old? And so the question is, where was the five-year-old educated? And they all said, no, we're not. They said, yeah, that's a good point. Where was he educated?
Well, that's right. Education has two aspects. It has the intelligence of the person and then the aptitude of the person. Aptitude is the Jeopardy show. Okay? Intelligence is being able to solve problems, being able to go from known information into the world of the unknown. That is done by smart, talented people. But even those
problem solving has always been the issue.
If you learn problem skills
in your own life, in your own business world, how can you expect to help other people?
You're exactly right. So, if we're thinking about the education system, and we think about the value of a decentralized, locally controlled and managed educational system. What better way to do this than to make access of the web? It's being done. There are online colleges. There are homeschools. There are satellite schools, charter schools that are using web-based training information. And these students across the board, even in bilingual homes, those students are outperforming students that came from government school.
I'm sure of it. This is why I have a best friend on the planet named Nicole out here. I told her I think the best thing, because she's extremely intelligent. Okay, she did get a degree at BA, I believe. But her intelligence level is such that she can actually teach her own kids in a homeschool situation with help from other schools. And with the, you know, important to her is to be able to have, and this is important to a lot of people, be able to have the institution of school where the kids meet other kids. And that's a concern for a lot of people, because homeschooling, sometimes they don't get that. But there's other things they can
do. You mean the continuous fashion show? You mean the continuous fashion show? You mean the peer pressure to do drugs and have sex? You mean the...
that's probably what it boils down to. But I think what she's saying is she's interested in the kid being able, because he's autistic, being able to adjust as a kid. But the kid is so well adjusted. Look, I went out there one night to an apartment. And her son and I sat there, and we did all his homework for an entire week in an hour. Because he's grasping to learn this stuff, but you have to challenge him. In other words, if I said to him, you can't do this, you're not smart enough to get this right, he would take that book, that it's like a little pamphlet, and he'd go in his own room, and he would do that work all by himself. If he had a question, he'd come out and ask him. But without being challenged to that, no. He'd rather watch TV, he'd rather mess around, he'd rather do anything else just to get you to go. But once you challenge him on things, boy, he's like, bang, right there.
Again, you come back
to the homeschool kid and to push him to those levels. There's a lot of work.
Yeah, but you come back to the fundamentals. The aptitude is an ancillary effect of learning how to learn. When I was in graduate school, I had a proctor who said, if you will continue after you get your degree to read 4 books in your field of expertise a year, every 4 years you'll have the equivalent of another PhD. Well, I took that challenge, except I didn't read 4 books a year. I read 50 books a year for the last 18 years.
Wow.
It made a big, big difference. So when when people come on this program and they talk to me in real life or they meet me in a business situation, eventually the comment comes out, hey, you're pretty well read. Yes. Because in the education system, I learned how to learn.
Right. And that's the point. You accepted and had the aptitude to want to learn. Okay? You wished it upon yourself. Most people don't want to learn. Okay, they just want it all to come for free.
Well, but that's not...
No, out here, humans are not... I've met lately, okay? I'm not talking about everybody. A lot of the people I hang with in these different places I go are probably on the lower level of the society. I do that on purpose for a reason.
And they're not happy. They're not happy, are they?
No, they're extremely unhappy and depressed.
Nobody is happy if they get something for free.
Against them. And nothing will get better, and nothing you can do about it. And these are the people I'm trying to convince that's incorrect. You can make your world better, but you have to do it.
Look, nothing will rob you of your integrity faster than having somebody who does not love you do things for you.
Right.
If you have someone who does not love you giving you free food every day, you will lose your self-esteem. You cannot have any self-esteem. You're not providing for yourself. You're not providing for those people that rely on you. There is no feeling in the world like sticking your hands in the dirt and growing a garden and reaping the fruit of it. And I say that figuratively and literally. People are happy when they do work and they see the benefits of that work.
Right. When you're done with your project, whatever you're working on, it's nice to look back at and say, wow, I did that.
Oh, but haven't we had a president lately say, no, Roland, you did not do that. You didn't do
that.
Right.
The government got you that business going. The government's reason your business is there at all. Did you hear that one?
Yeah, well, I have something very important that I want to read. Have you heard Charlie Daniels' open letter?
No, I have not read that.
Okay, well, I'm going to read it right here. Here we go. This is Charlie Daniels' open letter to President Obama. It's dated 2 days ago. Mr. Okay. Obama, it's not very long, so hang in there. You recently made a statement to the effect that if you have a business, you didn't build it. You had help, implying that the federal government helped build our businesses by virtue of paving roads and building bridges and keeping the nation safe from foreign invasion. First of all, Mr. Obama, if I'm going to take advice about business, it will not be from somebody who has absolutely no business experience like yourself. Secondly, Mr. Obama, I vehemently disagree with your premise. Where was your government when I spent as much as 16 weeks away from my wife and infant son to get a business started? Where were you on those cold winter nights when my old bus broke down in the middle of nowhere and we had to scramble to make the next show? Nobody from the government came along to give us a ride. Where was your government when I had to borrow money from a bank to make my payroll? Where was your government when I was digging out of a $2 million debt, playing every smoky beer joint I could to keep from losing everything I owned? Mr. Obama, I want to make you aware of a fact. It is the federal government's responsibility to build roads and bridges and keep the nation safe. That's what the federal government is supposed to do, not create an entitlement society that is totally unsustainable and pile up debt we can't pay. And who do you think paid for those roads and bridges in the first place and have been doing it for over 200 years before you were even born? The citizens do not need to pay more taxes. The federal government needs to stop spending money it does not have and has to borrow. Because the truth of the matter is that no matter how much taxes the government collects, things are only going to get worse, because you'll only spend it and demand even more. Mr. Obama, you have divided this nation by making the have-nots believe that anybody who has been successful has done so at their expense, that anything they've accumulated has been stolen, not earned. That hard work and risk had nothing to do with their success, because they've just been lucky and should give a big part of what they earn to the government to pass on to those who didn't even try to be successful. Look at what's going on with the African Americans who put their hopes and complete confidence in you and voted overwhelmingly for you. The unemployment rate is 14%, and the unemployment among young African Americans is something like 40%. Is that what hope change is all about? Look at what's happening in your hometown of Chicago, where the murder rate is through the roof. Do you think your base rhetoric about the unfairness of the successful in America is going to help soothe the situation? Have you ever considered reaching out to them instead of fanning the flames? Mr. Obama, I don't think you like America very much. I think you'd like to redesign it from the ground up to turn it into a lazy, unproductive, secular, socialist society. Well, that just won't flush. In a lot of ways, the most pompous that when all the productive people have given up and stopped trying, when all the investors stop investing, when 80% of the population is living on government handouts, your government is going to run out of money and this nation will sink into chaos. But Mr. Obama, I'm beginning to think That's exactly what you want. My help cometh from the Lord who made heaven and earth, not the government who made debt and class envy. What do you think? Pray for our troops and for our country. God bless America. Charlie Daniels.
Look, you got to love Charlie Daniels. I know I do.
Well, he's a great country artist. He is a fabulous American. And for him to personally take a risk, and it is a risk these days, to come out and write an open letter to the president that a lot of the press outlets published, I guarantee you right now he is on the president's hit list.
Oh, I'm sure of it. No, I mean, there's a lot of people out there like that. You know, they just don't like Americans. That's the way I see it.
Well, you bring up some good points, Roland. I always appreciate your calling. I got to move along now.
It's been a wonderful evening. I'll tell you what, you have a great week, sir.
You too. Thanks so much. Bring me more news from California next week.
I will definitely get back down next week, and I'll find out what's happening out here in California.
All right, Roland. Thanks. Bye-bye.
Okay, thank you. Bye.
So we have a lot of interesting subject matter tonight. Our phone number is 888-429-5471, 888-429-5471. This whole education edge thing, you know, if you follow the philosophy, you listen to the debates, which I did. I was very active on the school board in the state, Eastern Tennessee. I had a kid in every school in the county. Because my kids were spread over a number of years. So I had some in the primary, some in the elementary, one in the primary, one in the elementary, one in junior high, and one in the high school. So that's every school in the county. So I had a vested interest in keeping up. And that's where I learned about Education Edge and Goals 2000 and what the Clinton administration was doing. They had actually formed a 50-member national board. It wasn't a school board. It was more of an education board. But the members of that 50 person council were made of union leaders. Now, the goal, the task that this group was supposed to do is decide where the cluster cores were going to be distributed throughout the country. There were five cluster cores. I don't remember exactly what they were, but one was like hospitality, the other was healthcare, the other was science and technical, and then there was a general, and all five cluster cores were not available in all regions. They would only be available in those regions where those kinds of workers were needed. So if you had a son that was gifted in music and you wanted to send him to, you know, a school that had a music program and learn how to play better music, you had to move to a school that had those programs. Now, when would you have to move? I'm afraid that would be the third grade. That's right, because the education edge process begins in the third grade. Now, by the time you reach the 10th grade, you were to receive a Certificate of Initial Mastery, a CIM. That would allow you to go immediately into the job market or to receive additional training to get a Certificate of Advanced Mastery, which would be issued in place of the traditional high school diploma. Schools and businesses would be incentivized through a series of sanctions and tax breaks to hire or to place or to scholarship students that came through the CIM or CAM system. Why would they do that? Because the enemy to the system was the homeschooled student. What they were afraid of is that when they made this wholesale change to the educational system, that parents would pull their students out of the schools and would homeschool them. Now, we know that homeschooled students outperform public school students, and the network and money and everything behind homeschooling was really gaining momentum in the mid-90s and late 90s. And so employers would typically go for students that had advanced education, like a bachelor's degree or an associate's degree, etc. And those degrees were more often than not earned by students that came through homeschooling than they were through the public school systems. Well, now those businesses and colleges that provide those scholarships and provide those jobs would be incentivized to hire only CIM or CAM graduates, not the homeschooled student. The homeschooled student would not be eligible for those things because they didn't come through the process. The entire system was under a philosophy called school to work. And come on. I mean, how many times have you heard in the news just this year, and we're in July, just this year, that college graduates can't find a job, that there are no jobs out there. Our main concentration is jobs, jobs, jobs. You hear both sides of the aisle saying it. You hear the president saying it. You hear Mitt Romney saying it. When you have that kind of concentration on jobs, it tends to force the education system into an outcome-based process. It forces education into a school-to-work kind of format. In other words, you're not training thinkers. You're training workers. And this is a huge shift in the focus of the American educational system. Yes, we're behind in math and science, but only because math and science teachers are so hard to find. The math and science teachers that are in our schools now are behind the times. They don't know the math and science of today. They don't know the leading edge of where things are going. And believe me, I've met some fabulous science teachers. I met a science teacher in Odessa, Washington. I was very privileged to make presentations for 2 days in his classroom in Odessa, Washington. He was Science Teacher of the Year. Okay? That's the kind of talent that's out there. But this was a small school. And Mr. Ware was his name, was a fantastic teacher. He was up on the latest things. He kept up with the leading edge, and he kept his students very, very well stimulated. Most of them went to college. Most of them were members of small business and junior achievement, and they were really smart kids. I met them all, and they came to the plant. They saw what we were doing. They were all interested. They were intelligent. They remembered things. It was a great, great opportunity to meet a great, great teacher and his students. But the entire nation isn't like that. Math and science teachers around the country are struggling because they don't have advanced degrees in those areas that they're teaching. And most of the school systems aren't even audited to make sure that the instructor got good grades in those subjects in college when they got their degree in education. Some schools are requiring, you know, a concentration, a major in mathematics in college with a minor in education or something like that. They're requiring those things. But most schools do not because they cannot afford those teachers. A teacher with the math and science skills can make three times as much money in the private sector. Now, some states are making it available so that industry professionals, they've already been out there for 20 or 30 years. They've already made a fortune. They're already retired, or they're successful enough that they can take a few days a week and do something. They've allowed them to take a 90-day course to bring them up to educational standards, and they're making a transition as high school teachers. Now, I taught on the college level, and I can tell you that the kids that came into my algebra classes and my statistics classes were not prepared from high school to come into that class. Most of the young people that came into those classes needed remedial mathematics just to get ready to take that course because they didn't get it in the high schools that they were attending. I had one girl in one of my algebra classes that had never successfully negotiated a fraction, a simple fraction, didn't even understand the principle of a fraction. By the way, she passed my class because I'm an exceptional teacher. All right, let's take the rest of this hour. Let's do a drone wars update. Oh my goodness, there's so much going on here. I'm gonna play this this quick link because there's so much going on in the drone war business. I've got several links there I'm gonna play, but let's go ahead and get this one out of the way. Here we go.
It's Broadway theater with dolphin stars, original music, amazing choreography, and soaring action. Be part of something magical.
That's a shameless commercial.
The largest, most magical aquarium.
Sorry
Georgia
about
aquarium,
that.
Where
but,
imagination
it'll start here
play.
In just a second.
Buy
here
tickets online today.
Well, how about that? It only recorded the commercial. I love it. Anyway, what's really going on here? I mean, we have hundreds of police departments wanting the revenueing power of drones to scoop millions a week from passing motorists who are driving in a safe and prudent manner on federal highways. We have a surplus of thousands upon thousands of drones that have been cranked out of half a dozen factories under the highest priority by government orders. We have new, shorter, more lethal missiles that can be carried by drones the size of a go-kart at high altitudes. Why would Congress all of a sudden show up to the wedding with cold feet? Could it be that tens of thousands of listeners to this program have called their elected officials and told them of the inevitable? No. We're not talking about a little drone crashing into Aunt B's cucumber field. We're not talking about UFO reports going through the roof like they did in D.C. 2 weeks ago when sleek drones were flown over the Beltway. We're talking about that Second Amendment moment that Krauthammer was talking about. Remember? Let me just play it for you again just so you'll hear it.
A folk hero in this country.
This is Charles Krauthammer.
The first guy who uses a Second Amendment weapon to bring a drone down that's been hovering over his house is going to be a folk hero in this country. I don't want regulations. I don't want restrictions. I want a ban on this. A folk hero in this country. Drones are instruments of war. The founders had a great aversion to any instruments of war, the use of the military inside of the United States. They didn't like standing armies. A folk hero in this country. It has all kinds of statutes against using the army in the country. A drone is a high-tech version of an old army and a musket, a folk hero in this country. It ought to be used in Somalia to hunt the bad guys, but not in America. I don't want to see it hovering over anybody's home. A folk hero in this country. Yes, you can say we've got satellites, we've got Google Street, and London has a camera on every street corner, but that's not excuse to cave in on everything else and accept a society where you're always under being watched by the government, a folk hero in this country. This is not what we want. I would say you ban it under all circumstances, and I would predict, I'm not encouraging, but I'm predicting the first guy who uses a Second Amendment weapon to bring a drone down that's been hovering over his house is going to be a folk hero in this country.
I don't know if you can do that. Aren't they awfully high up?
Well, you may have to use a lot of them. You may have to use a very high-powered one. You may have to use a bazooka. I'm not encouraging. I'm simply making a prediction.
A libertarian.
A folk hero in this country.
All right, so you get the gist of it. Krauthammer on Fox News was saying that the first person that uses a Second Amendment weapon and shoots a drone down will be a folk hero in this country. Well, I can tell you, when the first $14 million drone gets a 7-millimeter Magnum hole through its brain and comes crashing down in Indiana with two Hellfire missiles aboard, the military response will make Waco, Texas look like a policeman's bake sale. No pun intended. Then there are the drone hijackers. The 19th of June, when University of Texas researchers successfully hijacked a drone by spoofing it, giving it bad GPS coordinates, they showed the Department of Homeland Security how civilian drones could fall into the wrong hands, exposing a potentially serious security flaw. It was exactly what Todd Humphreys, the lead researcher, anticipated in a TEDx talk in February. You can scarcely imagine the kind of havoc you could cause if you knew what you were doing with a good GPS spoofer. On Thursday, a month after the experiment, the investigations panel of the House Homeland Security Committee held a hearing on how civilian drones could affect the security of American airspace. These findings are alarming and have revealed a gaping hole in the security of using unmanned aerial systems domestically, said Representative Michael McCaul, the panel's chairman. Now is the time to ensure these vulnerabilities are mitigated to protect our aviation systems as the use of unmanned aerial systems continues to grow. The problem is the FAA and the Department of Homeland Security have yet to come up with specific requirements or a certified system to protect drones from GPS attacks. And what's worse, neither of them takes responsibility for it. The Department of Homeland Security mission is to protect the homeland. Unfortunately, the DHS seems either disinterested or unprepared to step up to the plate, said McCaul, noting that representatives from the DHS declined to testify at the hearing. The FAA declined to comment on GPS security after the spoofing test. Some of the drone manufacturers have their own systems to counter spoofing attacks, but others either think this is not their job, or they're not worried about it at all, or were completely taken by surprise. Dennis Annunzio, he's the chief technical operation officer of drone maker Rotomotion, said, "We've always been aware of GPS threats like jamming and lost satellites. But spoofing and taking control was something that we were not anticipating." So I'm going to go ahead and play this link to you. I hope it works this time, just to let you hear what's being said.
Now, before the hour, Congress has ordered the FAA to come up with a new plan to open U.S. airspace to drones by the year 2015. But there is new information this morning that the navigation systems of unmanned drones could be hacked, which would allow the wrong people to gain control of that aircraft. John Roberts on that story live in Atlanta. What did you find out, John? Good morning.
Hey, good morning to you, Bill. So far, the implications and the worries about thousands of drones flying across the country have been all about privacy issues. But a team of researchers at the University of Texas have recently uncovered a gaping hole in the security of these unmanned aircraft. In a series of experiments conducted over the last couple of weeks that Fox News had exclusive access to, the researchers hacked into the GPS system of a small but sophisticated drone with a so-called spoofer, one that mimics real GPS signals. They took complete control of the drone by sending it false GPS signals, making it go wildly off course several times. The implications of this are that a terrorist group could do the same thing and use it to crash a drone into a building, even another aircraft. Todd Humphreys is the lead researcher on the project.
In 5 and 10 years, we've got 30,000 of these drones inhabiting the national airspace, cohabiting it with the piloted vehicles. Each one of these could be a potential missile to be used against us if they had been commandeered by somebody on the ground.
Now, military drones have an encrypted GPS system that's difficult to hack into, but at the moment, in the civilian world, there is no protection, Bill, against an attack like this.
Well, is the government aware of this? You have to think they've thought about it.
The government is aware of this. In fact, just last week, Humphreys and his team were invited out to the White Sands Missile Range in New Mexico to show the FAA and the Department of Homeland Security what they could do. It's particularly worrisome because in the years to come, drones flying in U.S. airspace are going to get bigger and bigger. In fact, the founder of FedEx wants a fleet of cargo plane-sized drones to pilotlessly move packages across the country.
If we can do this with the small one, we can do it with the big one. And it just shows that the kind of mentality that we got after 9/11, where we reinforced the cockpit door to prevent people hijacking planes, well, we need to adopt that mentality as far as the navigation systems for these UAVs.
Now, the government is exploring a couple of programs to try to protect GPS systems. They're called Patriot Watch and Patriot Shield, but they are poorly funded and at the moment really aren't much more than a PowerPoint presentation. Experts I talked to say that they're worried that DHS brass really isn't going to pay a proper amount of attention to this until something happens. Bill?
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. They don't pay attention until somebody actually does it. Now, D'Annunzio said they have systems to deal with jamming and the loss of signal from satellites, but if somebody sends a spoofing signal and fools the drone's GPS receiver, then they have no answer because they can't detect it. To the GPS receiver, the signal looks just the same as the one coming from the satellite. If they work fine, everything looks good, none of the GPS numbers have changed, the GPS signal strength hasn't changed, how would I know, said D'Annunzio. Well, Kevin Lauscher, a representative from the commercial drone manufacturer Dragonfly, thinks this is not an issue at all. It's not really a big concern because our systems are designed to be flown in a very close proximity and quite low level, he told Danger Room. Indeed, Dragonfly drones, which have been sold to the Seattle Police Department, are built to be always under the scrutiny of an operator. So if something goes wrong, we simply land, he said. Well, sounds very interesting. I can tell you right now that they don't have the control that they think they have. And Adaptive Flight, which built the unmanned helicopter used in Humphrey's test that you just heard about on Fox News, is supposedly working on a system to counter spoofing attacks. Company CEO Wayne Pickell declined to provide details, but he told Danger Room that basically the firm is working on a system that would detect when a spoofing attack is being carried on. I don't know how they would be able to do that, which would allow them to turn off GPS navigation and take manual control of the drone. When asked how long they've been working on it, he simply answered, for a while. Well, if Adaptive Flight can turn off the GPS navigation while the drone is in flight and take control of it by hand and fly it, then why can't someone else? Why can't someone else turn off the GPS to it, take control, and fly it, just like they did the RA-170 that they took over in Iran and landed? Honeywell executive Prabha Gopinath told us that the firm's unmanned vehicles are already safe and are potentially able to withstand spoofing attacks. Good thing, too, Honeywell's so-called beer keg drone has been used both by military as well as the Miami-Dade Police Department. The machine relies on multiple sensors, not only GPS, to determine its coordinates, which also allows the drone to determine if it's receiving a spoofing signal. If they are used precisely, only the bad guys will be killed. Pakistani officials now rarely base their criticism of U.S. drone strikes on the incidence of civilian casualties and instead point, quite reasonably, to another objection, the U.S. violation of Pakistan's national sovereignty, Bergen notes. The Obama administration maintains that international law does not prohibit the use of lethal force against an active enemy when the country involved consents or is unable or unwilling to take action against the threat. The question is, who will end up on the president's kill list? The Bush administration detained and tortured suspected militants. The Obama administration assassinates them. Both practices not only visit more hatred upon the United States, they are also illegal. Our laws and treaties prohibit torture. The Constitution forbids the government from depriving any person of life without due process of law, that is, arrest and fair trial. Yet, President Obama has approved the killing of people, even American citizens, many of whom were not even identified before the kill order was given. Joe Becker and Scott Shane reported in the New York Times that Obama maintains a kill list. After consulting with his counterterrorism advisor, John O'Brien, Obama personally makes the decision to have individuals executed. Brennan was closely identified with torture, secret prisons, and extraordinary rendition during the Bush administration. The Times story, based on interviews with 36 current and former Obama advisors, reports that Obama has avoided the complications of detention by deciding, in effect, to take no prisoners. While scores of suspects have been killed under Obama, only one has been taken into U.S. custody, because he doesn't want to add new prisoners to Guantanamo. The leak of the kill list angered Republicans, evidently because they believe it demonstrates Obama's strength in foreign policy. I have no idea where they get that. Some progressives who do not fully understand the profound illegality of drone attacks find themselves preferable to the United States' all-out invasions of more countries. I mean, come on. We justified dropping two atomic bombs on civilians in Japan by saying that it saved lives. I mean, yeah, we killed 200,000 civilians, but we probably saved the lives of American servicemen who would have had to invade Japan to bring them to the same point. So we used that weapon to end the war in 3 days instead of three more years. That was the argument. Same thing here. We just assassinate the bad guys, and we ostensibly make the bad guys so afraid to step out in the open or to claim credit for anything that they've decided to do that's bad because they don't live very long. I mean, the average Hamas leader lives about 3 weeks after he makes the public announcement that he's the new leader. We need to understand that the unlawful precedent the United States is setting with its use of killer drones not only undermines the rule of law, it would also prevent the United States from reasonably objecting when other countries that obtain drone technology develop their own kill lists of persons those countries believe represent threats to them, and they fly their drones in our country and kill our people. Assassination goes around. On June 15th, for the first time, Obama publicly acknowledged that his administration is engaging in direct action in Yemen and Somalia. Although the United States is not at war with either country, George W. Bush's war on terror has morphed into Obama's war on Al-Qaeda. Obama's war has been used as an excuse to assassinate anyone, anywhere in the world, whenever the president gives the order. But there is not a distinct entity called Al-Qaeda that provides a good, sound basis for defining and delimiting an authorized use of force, according to Paul P. Piller, deputy director of the CIA's Counterterrorist Center from 1997 to 1999. The United States is not at war with Yemen and Somalia. Even if Obama identifies certain people living in Yemen or Somalia as members of Al-Qaeda who are desirous of committing acts of terror against the people of the United States, there's no basis in law for our government to declare war on individuals it considers a threat. The United States has legal means to indict and extradite, both under U.S. and international law. Since 2004, some 300 drone strikes have been launched in Pakistan. 20% of the resulting deaths are believed to have been civilians, although that has been greatly curtailed with better accuracy. The Pakistan Human Rights Commission says U.S. drone strikes were responsible for at least 957 deaths in Pakistan in 2010. In the 3.5 years since Obama took office, 585 civilians have been killed, including more than 60 children. The CIA's drone campaign has killed dozens of civilians who had gone to rescue victims or who were attending funerals. A new report by the London-based Bureau of Investigative Journalism found. But according to the Times article, Obama has developed a creative way to count civilian casualties. All military-aged men killed in a drone strike zone are considered to be combatants. Unless there is explicit intelligence posthumously proving them innocent. As a result, Brennan reported last year that not one civilian had been killed during 1 year of strikes. An administration official recently claimed that the number of civilians killed by drone strikes in Pakistan was in the single digits. Three former senior intelligence officials told the Times that they couldn't believe the number could be so low. Obama, who has been targeting suspected militants, they're called personality strikes, in Pakistan, Yemen, and Somalia, even killing U.S. citizens, has authorized expanded drone attacks whenever There are suspicious patterns of behavior at sites controlled by a terrorist group. These are known as signature strikes. That means bombs are being dropped on unidentified people who are in an area where suspicious activity has taken place. This goes beyond the illegal practice of targeted killing. People are being killed without even being an identified target. The administration justifies its use of armed drones with reference to the authorization for the use of military force that Congress passed just 10 days after the September 11 attacks. Congress authorized force against groups and countries that had supported the terrorist strikes, but Congress rejected the Bush administration's request for an open-ended military authority to deter and preempt any further acts of terrorism or aggression against the United States. Deterrence and preemption are exactly what Obama is trying to accomplish by sending robots to kill suspected militants or those who happen to be present in an area where suspicious activity has taken place. Christoph Haines, the current UN Special Rapporteur on extrajudicial summary or arbitrary executions, expressed grave concern about the targeted killings, saying they may constitute war crimes. He called on the Obama administration to explain how its drone strikes comport with international law, specify the basis for decisions to kill rather than capture particular individuals, and whether the state in which the killing takes place has given consent. Well, naturally, Obama did not respond to those requests. He doesn't think he has to. So, why is this important? It is vitally important. Do you care about Yemen or Somalia or Pakistan? Maybe you don't. Maybe you don't care about Baghdad and Afghanistan and Kurdistan and Turkey and various places where we might be flying drones. Would you be concerned if those drones were being flown here in the U.S., armed? I thought so. Let's get into this in the next hour. Here we go. By the way, it's not too late, even if, let's go ahead and play the Queen song. It's late, just because it's pertinent. We'll be back. Don't go away. Got about 6 minutes to go. Here we go.
To blame, but there's something inside that's turning my mind away. Oh, I could love you if I could let you stay.
Late. That's on the that's by Queen, News of the World album. Really, it's one of my most favorite songs by Queen. Freddie Mercury just does an outstanding job with that that song. Third hour of X Squared Radio tonight. Our AccuWindow forecast. It's now just a skunch below 80 degrees. We're coming to you live from an undisclosed location east of the Appalachians. Our phone number tonight: 888-429-5471. And we're almost done with our Drone Wars report. It's a little bit long tonight, but you need to have this information because you need to know the scope of this. This is not something, you know, sexy and neat. This is targeted assassination, which I can tell you what goes around comes around. We haven't seen any assassination in this country other than what appears to be activated PSYOPs agents, okay? We saw a congressman shot in Texas. She recovered, but she recently resigned her congressional seat to take full control of her complete recovery. This week, tragically, we saw a neuroscience student. I don't know what he was studying. Maybe it was mind control. We'll find out more in the coming weeks. Frankly, I'm sick of seeing it on the news. I'm sure you are too. I'm not going to mention the guy's name because that's not what we're about here on this program. But it appears that a little bit wacky, not violently so, no history of violence in his entire life, one minor traffic violation a year ago, all of a sudden, for no reason whatsoever, goes off the deep end and guns a bunch of people down in a movie theater. I really didn't have any kind of suspicion. Not a big conspiracy theory person. But I had friends who know more about this than I do. My good friend Nick Begich kind of turned me on to this back in 97 when he talked about how mind control could be used to develop an agent who has all of his training buried in his subconscious and can be triggered to take action with certain lines or certain signals or certain statement that could be made by somebody can activate this almost hypnotic action. And some of it can be quite elaborate. Geared toward, Lee Harvey Oswald style assassination of the president, and then very short order, that person is taken out themselves, so you never hear from them again, you never really get an explanation of what's going on. Why this guy is still alive is beyond me, but it wouldn't surprise me that we're not gonna actually hear from him. But I can tell you right now that assassination goes around. What goes around comes around. The Freedom of Information Act lawsuit filed by the Electronic Frontier Foundation against the Federal Aviation Administration regarding the licensing of domestic drones has finally produced documents detailing the use of drones, not in Somalia, not in Kurdistan or Afghanistan or Baghdad or Pakistan, but here in this country. According to a blog post written by EFF staff attorney Jennifer Lynch, the information obtained by the FAA includes details about the specific drone models some entities are flying, where they fly, how frequently they fly, and how long they stay in the air. Thousands of pages were delivered to the EFF in response to the Freedom of Information Act request submitted in April of 2011. Prior to the documents dumped on the EFF last week, the FOIA petition had already been answered in part by a list of all the entities, public and private, licensed by the federal government to operate drones in the skies over the United States. Lynch states in her report, the 18 entities represented in the files include police departments from Seattle, Washington to North Little Rock, Arkansas, about 10 public colleges and universities, a few federal agencies, including the USDA and Department of Energy, Idaho National Lab, and other entities like the City of Harrington, Kansas, and the Mississippi Department of Marine Resources. For every entity, the files include the actual certificate of authorization and many other supporting records. The files go back already several years. Several years. You didn't even know. You didn't even know. And they include the certificates for every year that the entity has had drones. For some entities, this is as early as 2004, 8 years ago. I can also tell you that the state of Indiana is doing the same thing, and they use it for support the highway patrol in writing tickets. Although the EFF has not been able to scour all the information obtained in the files delivered by the FAA, links to the files are provided on their website. I encourage you to go there, empower yourself, make yourself aware of this stuff. The New American has reviewed some of this information, and while it is disturbing, it is hardly thorough enough to allow a complete picture to be painted of the enormous potential for Fourth Amendment violations on the part of those who are now or soon will be at the joystick of these remote control spy planes. Now, Fourth Amendment, we're talking about privacy. This is not the only thing we're worried about. As I said, this administration will assassinate whoever they want, wherever they want, citizen or not. So there are four objectives, and this is a program: crash site related to interstate transport of hazardous materials, crash site related to railroad transport of hazardous materials, search and rescue operations, and tactical support of law enforcement operations. Now, that latter one, the fourth one, is where the money is. This is the activity that will bring in millions of dollars a week without putting more highway patrolmen on the roads. Speed taxing safe and prudent drivers who are just keeping up with the flow of traffic by sending them citations based on their license numbers that are photographed by the drones is legal. It is legal because it is not just a camera doing it. There is a person behind that, and they're an officer, and they are accusing you, and they are arresting you and writing you a citation and sending you the bill. Believe me, it's worth billions. Billions. Notably, the documents obtained by the EFF include mention of one request for better snooping capability on the part of any city government that was actually denied by the FAA. City officials announced plans to launch a blimp last April. The unique surveillance device is currently being developed by Weber State University, Utah Center for Aeronautical Innovation and Design. The guts of the machine were engineered to be completely integrated with both the existing surveillance cameras and the video monitoring headquarters that will come online any day. The originally stated goal was for the complete coordination and integration of all the cameras, the center, and the blimp to be ready last summer. Unfortunately for Ogden police, but fortunately for its citizens, the FAA rejected the city's plan for the blimp, citing safety concerns surrounding the operation of the blimp at night. The FAA, in its rejection notice, did not mention the fact that such surveillance was likely to result in daily deprivations of constitutional rights of the 82,000 residents of Ogden. Equally disturbing to constitutionalists should be the drone-deploying alliance formed between law enforcement and the public university located in Ogden, Weber State University. Such cooperation between police and professors may soon become commonplace, given details of a drone pilot program being developed in another state, Ohio. So there are a couple other things that go with this. One is that drones can now be electric, so don't use any fuel at all, and they can be recharged constantly by lasers from the ground, so they can be kept in flight virtually forever. This breakthrough technology will allow them to stay airborne for very long periods of time. Lockheed Martin and a company called Laser Motive has been able to keep a drone flying for some 49 hours nonstop, using a ground-based laser to recharge the drone's onboard battery. The test, says one of the engineers, was conducted in a wind tunnel in Palmdale. The system will very soon be tested in actual airspace in the desert, requiring coordination with both FAA and NASA to keep the ground-based laser from interfering with either commercial aircraft or Earth-orbiting space vehicles. Maybe it's police, maybe it's fire, maybe it's emergency services. If they need to be up overhead for a long period of time, that makes a lot of sense to put a system like this in place. It aligns very well with the president's directive to the FAA to prepare unmanned aerial systems into the national airspace to integrate them seamlessly by 2015. Did you understand that? Did you get that? So it's not just the municipalities. It's not just the cops that are saying, oh, my gosh, look at the way we could make money now. It's the president's directive to the FAA to prepare unmanned aerial systems into the national airspace to integrate them seamlessly by 2015. If you add this, if you add to this Raytheon's development of a brand new 2-foot-long missile, this is a miniature version of the missile. You now have drones the size of a go-kart that can carry missiles. And the larger drones, like the Predator or the Reaper, can carry not just 2 missiles, but 10 missiles, making them much, much more lethal. And I can tell you right now that there are meetings going on where the rhetoric, not the rhetoric, that's the wrong word, the operational language that's being used is that law enforcement needs to become more lethal. Each officer, each soldier needs to become more lethal. Now, on the one hand, you could say, well, this is a deterrent. Obviously, if our people are more lethal, then people won't take risks and won't break the law. But if these are clandestine operations anyway, no one even knows a drone is in the air. Nobody even knows they're being surveilled. No one even knows they're being targeted. Then how can it be a deterrent? It's sort of like having an unmarked car on the freeway. How do you know until the blue lights go off and some victim is pulled over and his money is extracted and the process of spanking the rash for another couple of years by the insurance company begins? How do you know that there is a law enforcement predator hiding on the freeway in and amongst innocent cars until the lights go off? You don't. Now, the idea is that most people look around and they say, oh, man, there's no cop around. You know, traffic's going 77 miles an hour. I think I'll do 78 or 79, just gently move through traffic and make better time. Unfortunately, the speed limit's 65 miles an hour. So once you get 10 miles an hour over, you can be cited, and it's a pretty hefty fine, a couple hundred dollars by the time you figure court costs. Well, if the police are able to pull over three or four cars at a time, they can really make a haul. But once they pull over one or two, well, then the word's out. Traffic slows down, and the revenue engine stops. So you use unmarked cars to be able to slide in closer to the prey so that you can continue to reap benefits. The next step is to move up about 5,000 or 6,000 feet above their heads. Nobody's looking up if you're driving, especially at night. But if that drone has high-resolution optics and it can look right down onto the license plate, you're just going to receive a citation in the mail. It's just going to be levied against your driver's license. And you won't be able to do anything until you pay that ticket. You won't be able to get a student loan. You won't be able to get a home loan. You won't be able to get a car loan. Nothing can be approved. Your business can be stopped dead in its tracks until you pay that citation. And let me tell you, it is a huge multi-billion dollar flow of money into local municipalities. There are currently 166 domestic applications for those drones to be flown in municipalities all over the country. And the initiative, the president's initiative, is to put 30,000 drones into the system. That's more drones in the air than there are commercial aircraft. That's right. No, there are not 30,000 airplanes in the air every day over America. But there will be. And they'll be the size of a lawnmower. Now, some people have written me. Most recently, somebody wrote me from Helsinki, or no, Oslo, Norway, today, and asked me for a Fukushima update. And so I am going to give you a Fukushima update. And a lot of this has to do with the radiation levels that are coming out of the plant. Some of it's technical. I'm going to try to explain it the best that I can so that you can make heads or tails of it. You can make heads of it, because some of this stuff can get kind of skewed in the press. You'll have officials saying, ah, well, you know, the radiation levels are very low. Others will get alarmist about it and say, oh, the levels are 1,000 times, you know, the recommended amount. Let's go through this. It's not that long. I want to explain it to you so that you're clear on it. Japan's Ministry of Health is now investigating a company that was tasked with decontaminating the damaged Fukushima Daiichi nuclear plant last year, which reportedly told its employees to artificially lower the levels of radiation measured by their dosimeters, or their dosimeters. Well, how would you do that? How would you artificially lower the levels of radiation? Ah, you're about to learn. Sources say that a recording of an internal meeting revealed that the subcontractor, Buildup, instructed its workers to use lead covers over their measuring devices. This incident is said to have taken place last December, a full 9 months after a tsunami triggered the worst nuclear crisis since Chernobyl. That means that their dosimeters will receive less incidents of collision, which would give them lower numbers. Well, how low? Ah, that's a good question. Employees at nuclear plants are exposed to no more than 50 millisieverts of radiation a year, per Japanese law. In order to prevent quickly reaching the limits while working in high radiation areas, managers of the company Buildup, that's their name, Buildup, instructed employees to shield their dosimeters with lead plates, as lead blocks the radiation because it's very dense and it's giant nuclei. To a certain extent, the measured levels were lower than what they should have been. Well, than what reality would have been. Several workers spoke out in protest, resulting in a meeting with one of the subcontractor's executives. He tried to persuade the workers into using the lead shields, like do it or you lose your job, as once they reached the 50 millisieverts, they could no longer work in their field of expertise. One employee protested that such an order was illegal, and after an argument, the executive stated that it was a voluntary decision, but workers say it was clear they were being threatened. They were told they weren't cut out to work at nuclear plants, and they returned to their hometowns to find another line of work. Three employees quit on the spot, but another nine have admitted to wearing the lead covers as instructed. A spokesman from Tokyo Electric Power, also known as TEPCO, you've heard that acronym in the news, the utility that operates the Fukushima nuclear plant, has said that the company received notice that buildup had made lead covers, but was under the impression that they were never used. Officials from the Ministry of Health have said that once they determined if any laws were violated, swift action would be taken. The amount of radioactive cesium-137 that flowed into the Pacific after the start of Japan's nuclear crisis was probably nearly 30 times the amount actually stated by Tokyo Electric Power in May, according to a recent report by a French research institute. The Institute for, and that makes sense, because the levels of radiation that we are seeing around the world are higher than what would come from what was reported as the actual dump into the sea. Now we know that the dump was actually at least 30 times, well, nearly, it says in this article, but it's probably more, 30 times the amount originally stated. The Institute for Radiological Protection and Nuclear Safety said the amount of the isotope that flowed into the ocean from the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear plant between March 31st and mid-July reached an estimated 27.1 quadrillion becquerels. Now, a becquerel, I'll explain that to you in just a moment. Just keep that number in your head. 27.1 quadrillion becquerels. A quadrillion is equivalent to 1,000 trillion. Okay, so we're talking about 27,000 trillion becquerels. The amount released as a result of the disaster triggered by March 11th earthquake and tsunami was unprecedented. The report also said the Pacific was polluted at an exceptional speed because the plant stands in a coastal area with strong currents. It's true. I mean, these currents are unbelievable. The ocean drops off sharply at this point. But the Institute warned that a significant degree of pollution would remain in the waters off the coast of Fukushima Prefecture, that's like a county, a prefecture, northeast of Tokyo. One becquerel is defined as the activity of a quantity of radioactive material in which one nucleus decays per second. Okay? The becquerel unit is therefore equivalent to an inverse second. The becquerel is named for Henri Becquerel, who shared a Nobel Prize with Pierre and Marie Curie in 1903 for their work in discovering radioactivity. You know that Marie died of leukemia from her research with it. In a fixed mass of radioactive material, the number of becquerels changes with time because cesium-137 has a half-life of about 30.17 years, which is pretty short for isotopes, and it also decays by beta emission to a metastable nuclear isomer of barium-137, 95% of which is stable. The beta particle will destroy soft tissue. So we're not talking about a gamma decay here. We're talking about a beta particle. That's an energetic neutron that comes off of the nucleus. So you don't want to put your cesium calibration coin, these come in little coins, a little bit bigger than a nickel, with cesium-137 marked on it, the little radiation symbol, and you use it for calibration. Usually they're harmless, but you don't want to put it in your pocket because they do decay. And this kind of decay is distance sensitive. That is to say, a gamma ray will go for fairly long distances and will penetrate clothing, and most metals like aluminum or copper pretty easily. But a beta particle can be blocked with something as simple as glass or a Haswapper uniform can block a beta particle from getting in. But these are very, very small, okay? We're just talking about a single neutron, you know, less than one atomic weight. The beta particle will destroy soft tissue, which means it can cause cancer. It's most of the beta decay that we use on purpose is in the field of oncology. We use it because cancerous tissues are typically much more dense than the normal soft tissues of the body, and so it sort of preferentially destroys cancerous tissues, but you will lose some soft tissue as well. There is a Japanese limit of 500 becquerels for a cow weighing 600 pounds or more. So we're talking about 500 nuclei. That's it. 500 atoms or fractions of an atom in a cow weighing 600 pounds. What we dumped into the ocean from Fukushima was 27.1 quadrillion. Okay? The official description of a dirty bomb is a speculative radiological weapon that combines radioactive materials with conventional explosives. Basically, what you're doing is you're taking radioactive material and you're blowing it up. You won't destroy the neutrons with this kind of explosion, but you spread them around. You blow them all over the place. The purpose of the weapon is to contaminate the area around the explosion with radioactive material, hence the attribute dirty. It's not actually an atomic explosion, but you're spreading these energetic neutrons around. They will beta decay, and they will cause damage. Though, a radiological dispersal device, also called an RDD, would be designed to disperse radioactive material over a large area. A bomb that uses conventional explosives would likely have far more lethal effect than the radioactive material. In other words, if you're in the range of the blast, you're probably going to be hit by debris from the blast, or your building is going to be torn down, or a hole in the street, or whatever collateral damage occurs with an indiscriminate explosion is going to be more damaging than the actual radiation. At levels created from probable sources, and we're usually talking about cesium-137, but in the case of, say, depleted uranium, those half-lives can be upwards of 12,000 years. Typically, not enough radiation would be present to cause severe illness or death. A test explosion and subsequent calculations done by the United States Department of Energy found, yes, they tested it, that assuming nothing is done to clean up the affected area, like rain or, you know, coming in with soap and absorbent to try to gather it all up and put it in drums and haul it away, assuming nothing is done to clean it up, and everyone stays in the affected area for 1 year, the radiation exposure would be fairly high, but not fatal. There was a BBC documentary called The Power of Nightmares, and it dealt with this effect. What they did not tell you in the documentary was the shadow hanging over the people who are expected who are exposed to such radiation. The slow and chronic exposure to elevated amounts of radiation has statistical health impacts such as leukemia and other forms of cancer. And that's widely known. But here's what's also widely known, and this is going to blow your mind. Recent analysis of the nuclear fallout from the Chernobyl disaster. Now, you remember what Chernobyl was. It was a carbon pile reactor, which means the containment was nothing much. It was just a concrete building with a concrete lid over it. And you use graphite to encapsulate the reactor. Now, what happened in Chernobyl, it was a test of an emergency shutdown procedure. Normally what happens, this is in the early days of reactors now, and this was a fairly primitive reactor, but the systems were sound. When the reactor is making steam, the steam is residual. That is to say, the reactor doesn't just cool off in a moment. So there's an emergency procedure that utilizes the steam made from that's spinning the turbines to operate valves which will drop the rods into the reactor and stop the reaction. The rods are lead rods that are dropped down into the reactor itself to absorb the neutrons that are bouncing around in there and slow it from being critical, from going into thermal runaway. So the day shift at Chernobyl was trained on these procedures. Well, Chernobyl is a rather remote area, and Russia is a huge country covering multiple time zones. And so to demonstrate this to government higher-ups, and I'm told these were some high-ranking generals that showed up, the day shift had already gone home. But the procedures were written down, and they were practiced, they understood them, and so the second shift was going to operate the test, even though they had never done so before. Well, what occurred is a series of errors. When the rods were pulled out and the reactor was allowed to heat up, the steam was going, the turbines were spinning, the Mach overtemp was fed into the system, and what happened was the rods got so hot that they seized in the bushings. And even though the cables above these lead rods were slack, the rods would not drop through the bushings into the reactor, and the reactor went into thermal runaway. Now, what happens is that it begins cracking the water, no longer making steam. It's cracking the hydrogen off the oxygen. And so you create what we affectionately call boom gas. This is a whole bunch of free hydrogen protons that float immediately to the top of the chamber because they're very, very light. The oxygen drops to the bottom of the chamber, creating effectively two layers, a hydrogen layer at the top and an oxygen layer at the bottom. Well, it doesn't take much heat, spark, anything, and it reunites these energetic protons and the oxygen to create a blast. Now, with a normal reactor, you have 15 feet of reinforced concrete over this area, and when that explosion occurs, it is devastating inside the containment, but hydrogen recombining with oxygen cannot possibly, in that amount of volume, create a blast powerful enough to go through a containment dome. But it could go through that building. It blew the lid off the containment, basically releasing all the gas that was in there. That was the initial radiation. But because the rods could not go down into the reactor to stop the reaction went into thermal runaway and it melted through the bottom of the reactor and it was headed for, you know, the core of the earth, basically. The only way to stop it is to pour tons of water on it to try to cool it off, which Chernobyl was fixed up to do, and to drop sand on it from helicopters, which is what they did. Now, when the firefighters arrived, of course, they hooked their engines up and started pumping the water to it. Helicopters flew over it and dumped gaylords of sand on top of it. All of the firefighters died. All of the helicopter pilots and crews died. And all of the first responders died. Everybody died that tried to fight that off. And they finally got it stopped from melting too far into the earth. So that's what happened at Chernobyl. But a recent analysis of the nuclear fallout, not the initial overtemp and the overreaction, but the fallout from the Chernobyl disaster is not going to be in gamma form. It's going to be in the form of these particles, small particles that get into the water, they get into the soil, they grow up in the plants, they're consumed by animals, it goes on and on and on. Well, it confirms this. showing that the effect on many people in the surrounding area, although not those in close proximity, was almost negligible. Since a dirty bomb is unlikely to cause many deaths, many do not consider this to be a weapon of mass destruction. Its purpose would presumably be to create psychological, not physical, harm through ignorance, mass panic, and terror. For this reason, dirty bombs are sometimes called weapons of mass disruption. Additionally, containment and decontamination of thousands of victims, as well as a decontamination of the affected area, might require considerable time and expense, rendering areas partially unusable and causing economic damage. Well, here's the gist of the study. On the 26th of April, 1986, reactor number 4 at the Chernobyl nuclear power plant blew up. 48 hours later, the entire area was evacuated. Over the following months, there were stories of mass graves and dire warnings of thousands of deaths, some radiation exposure. Yet, in a BBC Horizon report screened on Thursday this last last week, a number of scientists argued that 20 years after the accident, there is no credible scientific evidence that any of these predictions are coming true. The anniversary of the world's worst nuclear accident in April saw the publication of a number of reports that examined the potential death toll resulting from exposure to radiation from Chernobyl. Environmental group Greenpeace said the figure would be near 100,000. Another, Torch, predicted an extra 30,000 to 60,000 cancer deaths across Europe. But according to figures from the Chernobyl Forum, an international organization of scientific bodies including a number of UN agencies, deaths directly attributable to radiation from Chernobyl currently stand at 56, less than the weekly death toll on Britain's roads. When people hear of radiation, they think of the atomic bomb and they think of thousands of deaths. And they think the Chernobyl reactor accident was equivalent to the atomic bombing in Japan, which is absolutely untrue, said Dr. Mike Repicioli, a radiation scientist working at the World Health Organization. Scientists involved in the forum expect the death toll to rise, but not far. We're not going to get an epidemic of leukemia, Dr. Repicioli told Horizon, and we don't expect an epidemic of solid cancers either. So why have their predictions varied so wildly? Scientific as well as public attitudes to radiation are still dominated by the devastating effects of the atomic bombs dropped on the Japanese cities of Hiroshima and Nagasaki by the U.S. more than half a century ago. At least 200,000 people died almost immediately from the blast, and thousands more were exposed to higher levels of radiation than anybody had ever been exposed to before. The survivors of Hiroshima and Nagasaki became the most intensely studied people in the world. The detonation of the A-bomb, explains Professor Anton L. Brooks of Washington State University, was the first time that scientists had an opportunity to really look and to see the health effects of radiation, how much radiation was required to produce how much cancer. In 1958, using data largely drawn from these bomb studies, scientists came up with an answer. It was called the linear number threshold, LNT model, and suggested all radiation, no matter how small, was dangerous. It became the internationally recognized basis for assessing radiation risk. Yet, there has always been a problem with it. The data from Hiroshima and Nagasaki were for very high levels of radiation exposure, often in the range of thousands of millisieverts. There were no significant data for lower exposures, particularly below 200 millisieverts. The model was based on high doses, and we just didn't know what was going on at lower doses of between 1 and 200 millisieverts. Scientists simply guessed that if high-level radiation was dangerous, then lower levels would also be hazardous. They made an assumption. Chernobyl, where most people received radiation doses below 200 millisieverts, has been the first large-scale opportunity to test whether this assumption is true. The evidence from the Chernobyl Forum suggests it is not true. Low doses of radiation are a very poor carcinogen, says Professor Brooks, who has spent 30 years studying the link between radiation and cancer. If you talk to anybody and you say the word radiation, immediately you get a fear response. That fear response has caused people to do things that are scientifically unfounded. Other studies have come to even more startling conclusions. Professor Ron Chesser of Texas Tech University has spent 10 years studying animals living within the 30-kilometer exclusion zone surrounding Chernobyl. He has found that far from the effects of low-level radiation being carcinogenic, get this, it appears to boost those genes that protect us against cancer. That's right. One of the thoughts that comes out of this is that prior exposure to low levels of radiation actually may have a beneficial effect, Professor Chesser says. Today, although most radiation scientists are reluctant to sign up to radiation hormesis, as this phenomenon is known, there is a growing body of opinion that it is time to rethink the LNT model, and with it our attitude to radiation exposure below about 200 millisieverts. However, a number of radiological protection scientists still advocate the use of the LNT model. I'm one of them. In April, the World Health Organization's International Agency for Research on Cancer published a report that used the latest LNT-based radiation risk projection models to update the estimated cancer deaths from Chernobyl. It concluded that about 16,000 people across Europe could die as a result of the accident. Dr. Peter Boyle, director of the IARC, put the row over the figures into perspective. Tobacco smoking will cause several thousand times more cancers in the same population. Chernobyl was about as bad as a power station accident gets, a complete meltdown of the reactor core. Yet the lessons of the accident suggest that among the myriad of issues surrounding nuclear power, the threat to human health posed by radiation has been overstated. Two questions remain, my friends. First, do you believe the study and the published results? And the second is perhaps even more profound. Do you believe the government when it tells you something is good for you? So we should all take a couple of weeks vacation to the Forbidden Zone near Chernobyl. Go ahead and get our low dose of 200 millisieverts. Or go down to Oak Ridge and take a trip down by the Californium source and go ahead and pick up 200 millisieverts a couple times in our youth, and then we will have a better resistance to cancer. I wonder if the people of Utah, who recently won a multi-million-dollar lawsuit against the Department of Defense for testing of nuclear weapons in the air over Utah, which resulted in thousands of deaths, elevated statistically way, way beyond reason in Utah towns that were exposed to these low-level radioactive clouds. Those people that died of leukemia, brain cancer, liver cancer. They won because their town had a rate of death which was dozens of times higher than in the rest of the nation. For 40 years, the government was telling them it's impossible, that level of radiation could not have had that effect. Finally, after four decades of lawsuits, those towns were compensated. Not nearly enough for the lives that were lost. the amount of radiation that's poured into the Pacific Ocean and is dispersing around the planet comes from cesium-137. It has a half-life of about 30 years. We have about a little over 1 year gone from that that disaster. We have 29 years to go before half of the cesium has undergone its decay to a more stable barium isotope. That doesn't mean that the decay stops there. It means that half of it has decayed by then. And this is a statistical calculation. So my question is that what do we gain from this data? What do we learn from this? Is the Fukushima disaster as bad as what we think it is? Are my associates, who I trust their judgment, I have a degree in nuclear chemistry, and I understand the terminology, I understand the risk, I understand the precautions that we took in the lab with cesium-137 and with other isotopes. I've held in my hands sand from the Trinity test. I have spectrographically tested it myself. I've done neutron activation spectroscopy. I have used X-ray fluorescent spectrometers for years. I know how this process works and how the system works, and I know the kind of physical biological damage that it can occur if you don't use it correctly. So I have my doubts. I'm going to say the jury is still out for me, and I would rather not take a risk with 7 billion people on planet Earth on a study that was done over an area that was exposed in that way. I'm sure you feel the same way. I don't think that we should live in fear, but I also don't think we should live in ignorance. We try to be empowered by those things that tell us where to stand, those things that teach us how to get out of the way of the falling rocks in the sky. We know where to go. We know what to do. And I think we should do that. Now, next Sunday, we might run an archive. It's hard to tell. Got a lot going on. I plan on being here the 29th with a program. So tune in next week for X Squared Radio, and we will see you next week. Don't go away. Keep tuning in. Tell your friends about the program, and we'll carry on. Thank you, my friends. See you later.